We are walking in a circle. We are walking hand in hand. We are walking in a circle to create the promised land. To create the promised land.
We were just listening to the music of Genevieve Vaughn's song, We Are Walking in a Circle. Hi, this is Janie Reisner, and welcome again to Women's Voices. My guest tonight is Danica Anderson, M.A., certified clinical criminal justice specialist and fourth-year doctoral student. Danica has been working in Bosnia since March 1999. She is CEO of the COLO Trauma Treatment and Training and the originator of the Blood and Honey series of workshops, seminars, and trainings, and books to heal catastrophic trauma and to bear witness to the marginalized and invisible survivors of violence. A psychosocial gender victims expert for the International Criminal Court, Danica is a pioneering author writing about the South Slavic women's survivorship of one century of wars. Her new book, Blood and Honey, contains the extraordinary message of their first-person narratives, which speak of trauma as an opportunity for intensified learning. Her in-depth work with Bosnian Muslim women, war and war crime survivors, was furthered by Danica's bilingual capacity in speaking Serbo-Croatian. As a Serbian-American daughter of former Yugoslav immigrants whose mother survived concentration camps and an abused child herself, Danica was motivated to research trauma, Holocaust aftermath, and its impact upon communities. What she found through scientific social studies is how trauma impacts are significantly centered on the female, but from there, trauma radiates out into both genders and the community at large. Danica was a staff counselor with the United Nations World Food Program for the largest humanitarian workforce on the planet, the Sudan, including the Darfurs, and was responsible for counseling and trauma response for staff numbering 4,000. There she experienced violent rule of law with frequent attacks on employees and multiple harassment issues both in and outside the organization. Working from a base as a forensic psychotherapist, a substantial amount of her work has been done in several countries in Africa, Bosnia, India, and Sri Lanka. And her work experience began with sexual abuse and abuse issues as an Indian child welfare director. Her soon-to-be-published book, Blood and Honey, Women's Wisdom and Catastrophic Violence, along with many other articles archived in English from Serbia, Croatian to six languages. When not traveling and working abroad, Danica is married with two children, calling Olympia, Washington, her home. Welcome, Danica.
Wow, that is so long.
Well, you have had quite a life.
Well, yeah, it seems like I was busy there. I was just surprised. Sometimes I think about all the extraordinary people that I've met and all the things I've learned, and it's really quite a list.
And there's probably even more.
Much more. There's a lot of stories in between there. The best university are the people, aren't they?
Well, that's true. Well, you know, my question is, and I know this goes to the heart of your work, is how did your mother influence you to become who you are today?
Well, it was largely in a negative way. Herself being a victim, of course, surviving a concentration camp, she really did the best that she could. But there was this huge absence. It was very, absence. It was really quite difficult in the way it was either neglect, or if you did have any kind of attention, it was actually either physical or verbal abuse, so to speak. Other than that, you know, we were As girls, we were assigned very secondary status and certain chores, and very stereotypical and very much what a good Serbian girl must do. So, obviously, I did not conform to it very well right from the start, so that sent a big target out to both my parents and my mother. But the way she lived her life, I did not want to ever have a life like hers. And I think that was the gift that she gave me. And who I am today is really carved out from those types of experiences. And my mother not having that nurturance and that ability or capacity as a victim herself to be able to, you know, be that mother for her daughters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your father, I don't hear much about him. Apparently he wasn't as abusive, or he...
Oh, he was the most abusive.
I see.
My mother just tended to do the, what I call a certain kind of victim stance, where you either get silent or you're standing by as all the cruelty starts to happen and the abuse. And I remember asking my mother, why didn't she intervene? With the beatings, with the emotional, the terror. I mean, I just remember being in terror most of my life. And she says, well, when you become a mother, you'll know. Well, I became a mother, and I still cannot comprehend it. I could not, as a mother, stand by and watch my child being beaten, terrorized, just some of the things that happened that supposedly were typical Serbian culture. But then again, I would ask her the question, what's the difference between culture and violence? Because this is not Serbian culture. And so she had a lot of complicity in that sense, where my father really, you know, could do whatever he wanted in terms of power, the beating, and the abuse. And she pretty much didn't do anything, had no say. She was very much in her victimhood.
Well, that certainly set you on the path of what you're doing.
I remember when I was very little, I looked up at my parents, and I realized, even at such a young age, that they were sick. I remember thinking they're sick, and I didn't realize until more as an adult and as a teenager that sense that I felt with them of being sick was really most likely trauma, that they were extremely traumatized.
Of course, of course.
But when you're young, you don't quite figure it out. You just, you know, call it, you know, a sickness.
Yes, yes. But you, that's certainly, I mean, it's such a powerful thing that you've done, that to come out of that and realize you want to change it. You want to help people.
Well, no, I really don't want to help people. I think of help as a four-letter word. I prefer the other four-letter word, which is heal. I wanted to heal myself. And I remember I didn't have a choice. Very early on, I figured out I didn't have a choice in what I would end up contributing to the world or where my place would be in the world. And I accepted it very, very early. I remember that. So I knew I was going to be on a certain pathway, but it was all very... I think when you have children of Holocaust survivors, whether they be Jewish, whether they be... from Russia, there's so many places all over the world, even in Asia or Africa, where there's been all this conflict with genocide, gynocide, and what have you. And you're being raised by parents that are survivors of that. And you tend to walk around as if you're walking on eggshells. And then you also inhabit the world of trauma. And what you look at, or for myself, when I look back at my childhood, was I knew I had to heal myself. I knew that I could not metabolize all that hatred, all that anger, all that fear, because it would damage me beyond repair. But I put everything into how do I heal myself. And I knew that when I went out to talk and work with these other people, is that I was their student, because the Bosnian women war crime survivors I work with and the war survivors, they had so much wisdom. I didn't go through that war. Yes, some of them did go through a very abusive childhood, whether they be Bosnian Muslim or Croatian or Ukrainian or whatever. There's this certain kind of atmosphere where they raise children that can be quite cruel at times. So we had that in common, but I didn't survive a gynocidal or a genocidal war either. And I knew that how I healed myself was being layered upon by how they healed themselves and how they healed the whole community. So I had an intense curiosity about that, which of course is, why do we have trauma? Why do we have violence? And then the real third question that I keep going after is how do we heal?
Where does the blood and honey, is this kind of the center of your work, those words? Where does it come from and what does it mean?
Well, the Balkan War, the word Balkan actually describes blood and honey. And Balkan is actually a Turkish word, but it's applied to a lot of Eastern Europe or the former Yugoslav region, and that means blood and honey. And the term of blood and honey, if we go back to much more ancient mythologies and what we call oral memory traditions, those oral memory tradition practices are very, very old. They're like Neolithic, if not Paleolithic, in origin. And these are certain kinds of rites, our rituals and practices that we do continually, like the round folk dance, which is called a kolo, but it also means to be in a circle. So you could either be in that round folk dance or just residing in a circle or like you and I talking. So I realized with that oral memory traditions that I had something and that we could actually look at that and say, wow, what is this? So when I go around and I say blood and honey, especially with the Slavs, they don't look at it as, you know, the war or the violence, but they understand that the blood meant that nurturance to for women, like menstruation, menopause, for pregnancy, all of those things that came from blood that, you know, we can bleed without dying and we can be fertile and give birth. I mean, it's just amazing, right? And the blood flows across the face of the earth in terms of the water, the rivers, the oceans. And then, of course, honey is also the milk, the breast milk. And there's so many other things that are the honey. So they really apply it to a very earth-based spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Life. It means life in a certain way.
Yes, and it's a way of my taking back that terminology of blood and honey away from the violence, away from the century of wars that the South Slav people, former Yugoslav region, had endured. And not only that, how many other peoples across the face of this planet that have endured for thousands of years at times. I mean, we could look at the first peoples here in the United States and the genocide that we practiced upon them.
Yes.
I mean, the same thing, what I call gynocide, because the target here was the womb again. So.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I use that the term blood and honey, because it's very iconic and it's symbolic and it can immediately bring up issues or have someone ask a question. And as soon as they ask that question, I know I have curiosity. If I have curiosity or interest, I know that we've begun the healing process. Mm-hmm. There's no longer this fear or this fright.
Mm-hmm. You are on Facebook, and I see your many posts on Facebook, and much of it has to do with women doing the kolo dance, and there are other matriarchal folks who also post that, and I'd never heard that word before.
Well, the word kolo is very, very old. It really relates to when we go back Indo-European script, our language, and even farther back, they think even like to Sanskrit. But the word kolo, its original meaning meant the wheel, which means what's circular, right? And if it's the wheel, it also means that we have a movement that we can move through, we can evolve, and we have this kind of circular motion to it. The other thing is with the wheel, it measures the circumference of the earth. Everything's round. Everything's round. The earth is round, and how they knew this even from long ago, it's incredible, right?
Mm.
So taking that old word, we found out through a lot of anthropology and also archaeological artifacts and what have you, that the kolo is actually Mesolithic in age, that this has been a continual practice through these thousands of generations. And what I mean by that is that there's a way with memory that's been taken into, like, say, the colo. So it involves the body, not just the mind. It involves the mind, the brain, the soul, the spirit, and it moves together. It's very inclusive, right? They know that even on a neurological level, that when we perform, for instance, somatic movement or repetitive actions of any kind of somatic nature, it's a sensor-motor kind of psychotherapy. And the bodies in a circle structure actually tends to repeat things. And then, another way, it layers memory. And it actually cancels out all that fright and all the other types of things that are very traumatizing, let's say, or the violence. And it becomes a very, very healing effort and practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it actually mirrors how we layer memory neurologically. And I find that fascinating. And also that the colo being so old and as the wheel, that this has been known for countless generations.
Yeah, for everyone to participate in this dance. I know you talk about it as being healing. And the wonderful costuming that everybody wears.
And, you know, the thousands and thousands of hours of needlework or embroidery or the chilims that they make, the rugs. And that's found throughout most of Eastern Europe, Russia, and Baltic nations, and, you know, the Finnish and the Swedish, and back down, you know, through South America and the Mexicans and all that, very similar types of design and, you know, symbols. So, in other words, they were having a colo with the needle, let's say, or with the icons. It was another way that had, using their hands, that repetitive motion. So in a sense, their hands were doing the colo.
Right. So it was so healing. I'm speaking with Danica Anderson, author of Blood and Honey, Women's Wisdom and Amid Catastrophic Violence. So I've thought about this many times myself. I don't have any costuming. All of that's been taken away from us here on this side of the world. I realized that it must carry a lot when this is who you are by what you're wearing.
For the Slavs, even for the Russians, but for instance, the South Slavs especially, when you look at our language, it's very much related to the landscape. So some of the proto-Slavic words, for instance, named the trees that were specific to geographic areas. Mm. You know, for instance, if the birch trees, you know, only really grew in the alpine levels of the forest, they would have names for that. So they actually refer to the landscape through language as well. Well, the same thing with costuming. I can tell in South, in Bosnia, Serbia, Bulgaria, but let's refer back to former Yugoslavia region and stuff, whether the person wearing that costume is from Macedonia, from Serbia, from Bosnia area, let's just say even from Sarajevo, or from Zagreb, or wherever in that kind of land. And that costume and that needlework and the symbols on that needlework and all that tells me the land that they came from.
Hmm.
And I think you're right. We don't have enough costuming. We, most Westerners, or let's just say the United States, most of us don't even know the plants in our backyard, let alone the animals. And whereas they do, most of them really, really know how the land works, what the landscape's like, and so their costuming is very much a weave and harmony with the environment, knowing that the environment shapes us. And I think it's a loss. I remember talking to this one woman in Crete, and she was really quite young, and she was dressed all in black, and she was actually wearing a scarf and all black, and I knew that that was the dress, or like you said, the costume of a widow. And I said, "You're much too young to be a widow. How long have you been in a mourning?" And she goes, "Well, I guess she was in her early 40s, and she goes, "Well, it's been about 12 years. And I said, "Oh." you're so young to keep wearing that all the time. She goes, no, it's complete liberty. She goes, I love wearing my black scarf, my black skirt, my black, you know, hose, and my shoes and my top, and I have so much liberty. Whereas before, I would always be watched, I could be talked about or gossiped. So I really love the idea of how she used that costume in order to have liberty.
Angelina Jolie did a movie, Blood and Honey.
Yes.
Do you have any comments about that? I haven't seen it. Is it connected to your work in some way?
Yes, it is. About 6 years ago, I had a crew, actually a writer, Angela Soper, and also a filmmaker, Norm Klein. They were very interested in doing a documentary. And they asked me what title it should be, and I said Blood and Honey. So we looked for funding and everything else, and it really went out there quite a bit. We found out that the year that the movie was being released, actually 2 months before it was being released, that Angela Jolie was making this movie and has the movie title of Blood and Honey. And we found out when we approached her that they used my website, my information, a lot of speech notes, but they weren't going to acknowledge that, you know, they were going to go on with it. And they actually said it was from another book that has the title of Blood and Honey by a Croatian author. Subsequently, her director of the movie and also this Croatian author are in court as for a lawsuit over certain, I guess, rights to the movie and something else. I don't know what the whole thing was about. But the women in Bosnia knew this was going on and did not tell me about it. And they realized that I wasn't doing it, so they were really grateful because they felt like they were being exploited for money and everything else. But the woman in Sarajevo, who is in charge of the, I think it's Women to Women, and she had survived a rape camp, which is what this Angela Jolie's movie is about. I have not seen it, so I can't really comment on that. And they felt that they really sexualized that whole movie and it wasn't the reality. And they requested to have a meeting with Angela Jolie, which she never responded to. And they were really quite upset to the point where all these women, even from the women I worked from in Bosnia and then also in Sarajevo, that they boycotted the film festival when that movie was released. Mm-hmm. And they asked everyone to not see it. And then they wrote a letter to the UN asking that Jolie not to be an ambassador. And that's all I know about it. I mean, it's funny how word gets out and how things could be taken and moved around. And I thought, well, I just did not want to change the title of my work and everything, because I was definitely predates this movie. And one of the Bosnian women says, don't you worry, Danica, because it's the real Blood and Honey story.
That's great. How do you talk about healing. So you come into these communities. I'm sure you're well known. How does healing occur? What do you do?
It's not so much how I do. It's almost how receptive I am. In other words, I don't go there to help, because once we say that we're going to help you, that puts you in a power position. And that also makes them feel, what, you're always a failure, correct? It's got to be something wrong with me if I need help. And you've got to understand that most people, not just in, you know, former Yugoslav region, but across the world where they have conflict, that a lot of the helping aid organizations help. And it's not much of a help. There's a lot of outcry about it. Anywhere from, I was in Haiti 9 days after the earthquake, and I can tell you how they even demonstrated. I don't know where they had the energy. They demonstrated against the UN when I was there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've heard many stories, yes. It was pretty awful, I'm sure.
Right. So that word help is actually a bad four-letter word to a lot of nations and peoples that are suffering or enduring the aftermath of war, or even during war, a natural disaster. And the thing here is that they knew somehow I came there to heal. And one of my main things that they sensed was how I had children. And I thought to myself, when the war broke out in 1991 through 1994, basically, that my mother and my grandmother and my great-grandmother, so we had a century of war in my family alone. And I looked at my kids and I thought, I don't want that for my kids. How do I heal this so that they won't have to endure this? So it's actually for a very selfish reason. And they somehow identified that because they too do not want another war.
Are you now speaking of your children or the women in Bosnia?
The women in Bosnia.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, one of the healing things is very painful. I feel like I rip off the wounds that are so scarred, and the way they're scarred, it's so badly. You know, if you have a scar and if you don't heal it or you attend to it and change the bandage and clean it and put a new bandage on a very daily, repetitive type of response, you have this huge keloid scar coming up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I basically go in there and I rip off this scar, and then the healing comes again. In other words, it becomes very confrontive. And one of the things could be we had a colotrauma training meeting. I took them to the Bosnian coast. Again, most of them didn't even have money to go on a bus ride outside their own town. So we had enough donations, and we were able to go to the coast. And then I had a session there when I asked them, it was about their children, and the idea came up about my children. And I said, well, you know, so far my children are not going to go through another war like my parents were, or your children have now. And I had them look at what were some of the contributing factors. And there was quite a bit of heated discussions. And then one of the women stood up. She goes, you know, my children now live in Germany, and my grandchildren are all there. They're no longer here. And I realized when I was talking to my son before I left here to come on this trip, she said, and she started to cry at this point. She goes, I've taught my children how to hate.
Hmm.
She goes, that's where I'm going to start. I'm going to heal that hatred.
Hmm.
And she thought healing was the best answer for any kind of hatred.
Hmm.
So how do you hate? How did you promote hating? And we could do that from racism, ageism, criticizing, always judging. The whole thing that our world really is doing as it is, just even in the Western culture, are still some aspects of hatred. And it was very difficult for this Bosnian mother and most mothers to realize as they were sitting there that we couldn't have had a century of wars unless we'd really taught our children to hate. We perpetuated it somehow. Either we did not stand up to it, or as mothers, you know, most of them said, you know, we don't have much power, you know, we're not being listened to. What could we do? Oh, woe is me and poor is me. And then I also told them the story about my mother, how she could stand by with all the beating, think that that didn't help contribute. Because for every offender that we have a victim that also made it possible.
Hmm.
And it's not to blame the victims either. But I think what happens is that it's very lucrative in a way to be that victim, because then that way you can avoid responsibility for your own life and your own choices and how you can remove yourself from it.
Well,
you know, it's one thing to be a victim, and it's one thing to live out the rest of your lives as a victim. And with the Bosnian women, and most Slavic women, they do this. They're exquisite victims. It's almost like medals on their chest and stripes on their arms, and it's something that they can't easily walk away from.
Yeah, well, I think if you don't have anything that intercedes with that view or nothing to very much feel good about, I can understand that. You
yeah.
know, when you mention that, I certainly do think there are victims. I mean, we're looking at what's happening with women all over the world right now. That's horrific.
Yes, it is.
And it isn't because we aren't speaking up. I mean, we're doing all of that, and power is power. And, you know, if somebody's killing you, there isn't, or raping you, there isn't a lot you can do about it in the moment. And I think this is true all over the world, that women are trying to speak up.
You know, that's the kind of victim that it is. There's a difference, though, when you stay in that victimhood. And there's not enough healing to help quite a bit of these victims to be able to speak up. I mean, most of us that we talk or that we know in our world we do our act. In other words, in fact, most of us do hate that victimhood. We'll walk, you know, the talk, so to speak. But as a victim, if you live out the rest of your life as a victim and always in fear, it's very difficult unless you have healing or if you have a structure like a community. And what do I mean by that is that women literally manifest culture. We know that. And maybe one of the ways is this social intelligence that's embedded in the circle or in the colo that we use that allows it to have a very healing effect on every member, so that if they've been victimized, and when you're standing shoulder to shoulder with someone, or sitting, you know, next to someone and just sharing, or even doing that round dance, you could actually localize that memory, that trauma memory that's just, you know, very terrible. But then it gets layered over by another sense. And that sense is that of healing and just sitting with others, and that you have this social collective and community that can actually support you and help move you out of that victimhood. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the Bosnian women, and most women I felt, even in the Congo, when I work with the Congo with all the rape, the wars and the violence take away their community and also their capacity to heal. No, I think you're right. I mean, we just have to look at certain parts of this and then understand when, okay, we no longer are at that point of being a victim. We're moving through that, and there's got to be some changes there.
Mm-hmm. I want to say this is Janie Reisner. You're listening to Women's Voices. My guest is Danica Anderson, and we're speaking about her work and her book, Blood and Honey, The Secret, Her Story of Women. And your book has, I mean, you've got more than one book. You've got several books.
Yes, I do. The one book that's out now is Blood and Honey Icons, Biosemiotics and Bioculinary, where I have vignettes of the women's trauma stories, like you said, but then I also have the herbs and some of the recipes that seem to be a pattern with those types of stories that I encountered. And I knew that that kind of pattern meant something, and that that was trying to do a very social message and memory that I think we all need to look at. So I did that book, and the Blood and Honey Secret, Her Story, is going to be out soon. It's in its final copy editing, and that's a longer narrative on all the women's stories.
Well, how will people find about your work and perhaps getting in line for the books?
You can go to my website, which is KOLO, and then the word collaborationtogether.org. And then from there, it'll give you a list of the books and where to go and to do. And, of course, I'm on Facebook, and you can go underneath my name, and then also I have a Colo group.
Okay, and that's Danica Anderson.
Right, and that's spelled Danica, and then Anderson. Mm-hmm. And then if you wanted to send me an email, you can send an email to me at Danica@ColoCollaboration.org.
Danica@ColoCollaboration.org. And you talk about food, too, and how important that is.
Yeah, it's the bioculinary. One of the things of the colo and the circle is that, you know, the men really loved the food, but they also loved, you know, being a partner to growing the food, for instance, making wine from grapes. There was this harvesting. There's actually a folk round dance, a colo round dance that's about stomping the grapes. There is all these things that combine together so that when they sit down at their table, it is a feast. Whatever they have every day, it becomes this beautiful ritual, and everybody comes together, or they will go out in their yards and pick the, you know, apples from their orchard tree, or the plums and the peaches, and the flowers they will have everywhere, and the vegetables. So there's this kind of sacredness that really evolves them and brings them into the moment. And it's, again, through, like, their daily activities. So bioculinary is a response to our biological process that needs food. also understands that it's greater than that, that it's just that that culinary aspect. You could actually heal yourself with the proper foods. If you eat certain foods at that time of the season, it's best right off the tree, or I just picked that salad from the field, whatever it is, or I just milked the cow and, you know, here's the milk. They're just so celebratory and very grateful for all those gifts. No, I couldn't talk about the way I do trauma healing. And the thing is, it's not just with the Bosnians. I mean, I would find this even in Sri Lanka, in Africa, the Congo, Uganda. I found this in Sudan. It didn't matter where I went. It tended to be quite universal. It was really kind of incredible that when they had nothing, they had everything. They started to heal. For instance, in Bosnia during the war, and even that aftermath, they couldn't afford any socialized medicine. So they understood that the birch tree, and one of the largest stands of birch trees are left in Bosnia, by the way, they know that that's an antiseptic. So they were able to use that antiseptic and do a whole bunch of things, or even make certain kinds of wines from different kinds of plants and trees. It was really kind of interesting. But I found that everywhere I went.
And they're able to do that in spite of everything else that's happening, which is kind of amazing.
Even with the Bosnian women, it was very, very interesting that no matter how difficult it was in the aftermath, I would come in with, you know, I never really got a lot of donations, but whatever donations I had, I would give to them and it would be cash. So all of a sudden, these women who were pretty much marginalized and invisible were the ones that were revving up the economy for their small town, right?
Huh.
And they fed the whole village. They paid the driver. Everyone got something. Whereas when I used to give it to the men that were in charge or, you know, the mayor or whatever, it never got to everybody. In fact, it rarely got to anyone when I think about it. But when I did it this way, it was much more collective and it was much more joyous. And you could just see this movement moving through that they... money was just a means, but it was also something that heals them at that point, instead of having money as power.
You put many wonderful pictures on Facebook of scenes, of pastoral scenes, of embroidery, of baking. It's interesting to me is like the loaves of bread that have certain symbols on them that seems to be very important.
They have series of breads that they make throughout the year, but one of my favorites is the egg bread, and they also do braids on the bread so that it becomes like a cross. And the cross, of course, it's, you know, related to either the Catholic or the Serb Orthodox Church, but the cross is, again, like the word kol, very, very ancient in meaning, and it actually represents truncated trees in a forest. And it shows a lot of the Slavic kinship to the trees. So everything they make, from their weave and spinning and needlework to their baked goods, especially like bread, and that is really sacred because there's something about, you know, kneading the dough with your hands, with your thumb, and with just making sure that it rises. It's a very alchemical process. And for them, it was very spiritual. Therefore, you dress the bread like you would your costume or of your hair, and it would most likely be in the sign of the cross. And then with the egg bread, they would make enough room so that you can actually put eggs on the top of the bread so the eggs don't roll. I just think it's so beautiful. A lot of times it is set out onto the ledge of their windows to cool, and everybody smells this bread. Of course, a lot of people grab it, too. Then she has to go back and make some more. It's really a beautiful thing, a very, very nice custom.
Oh, it's wonderful. It sounds like the fairy tales I used to read where they'd in the thatched roof houses and the grandmother would put the apple pie to cool on the windowsill. Charming, absolutely.
When I'm in Novi Travnik, I usually go out for a walk early in the mornings, and my hostess, Susanna Kordich, would say, you know, then he said, don't you want to have breakfast or something? I said, no, I'm okay. And she knew it because I'd go for a walk, and I must have had 30 or 40 people ask me if I wanted coffee or tea to come in. Somebody would have their bread made, or somebody else would have, you know, fresh eggs or milk or... It was a feast. It would always take me 2-3 hours to walk what normally would only take me 30 minutes.
Sounds wonderful. Can I come with you next time?
That's so much fun. And even if they had nothing, it was just incredible. And I would wear a backpack. So a lot of times I brought my own chai, my tea, and also coffee in small packets for them because I realized that they couldn't quite afford it. But for them, it reminded them of pre-war days that when you have a traveler and you have an unexpected guest, that is really sacred. And so they would open up their doors. Hmm. The other thing is I'm very good at reading cups, and they just love that. I mean, they could sit for hours reading their coffee cups. And
to say more about that, what do you mean, reading cups?
Well, you know how you do the tea leaf readings or the grounds of the coffee? And it's been known as a fortune-telling practice, but the reality is that it's not. And that's the term biosemiotics. It's the ability to cluster meaning from the signs, and you could read that on the bottom of the cup. They found out I was really good at that, and so I found out that a lot of these women were really good at that. In fact, they could probably have written Maria Gimbutas' book on signs and scripts from Vinca.
Really? And that's where she comes from, isn't it?
No, she's Baltic.
Baltic.
She came from there. But yeah, they have a lot of relations in tandem with each other.
And so it's a matriarchal, in the beginning, a matriarchal society, right?
Yes, yes. And that's been totally beaten down into submission, but it still bubbles up and it still comes around. And it could really move or sway quite a few things. But it has to be done very incognito, or it has to be done very passively.
Hmm. Well, as you're describing all of this, it's clear it's the women who are creating the community and the home on many levels.
Oh, yes. And the thing is I know every mother, they could not exclude their son or their daughter. Something happened at that point when I said, how can you choose between your son and daughter? And all of them would say, well, I couldn't, you know. And I said, but what point is it that we couldn't give ourselves permission to stand up and say no? Because, you know, really, what mother wants to send their son off to guilt, yes, or to have their daughter killed? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
The other thing about your coming is you're witness to the violence that has been done to them.
You know what? When you bear witness, I think to me that is probably the skill I've been trying to work on most of my life. And I think it's a lifelong, if not many lifetimes long, skill that needs to be honed. And it's like watching what happened to them and knowing you can't change the world and you can't change their world. And your hands are tied behind your back as you watch this unfold. And to bear witness, though, for that person moves them out of victimhood. It moves them into, oh, someone acknowledges that I exist. My story isn't invisible.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm sure.
And that was the vow they had me do with these books. I no longer thought I was going to be an author. It took me 13 years to write all of this, and it's because the women made me do it. And I realized that was that form of bearing witness for them, that, okay, they really didn't need it on a piece of paper in a book. They knew that they had it in at least one person that did not live there, lived across the other side of the pond, so to speak. And that was invaluable for them. And so this is just like frosting on the cake, that these stories exist. No matter how much they've been bombed, raped, mutilated, their homes taken away, or they don't have food, or what have you, they exist.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, for me, bearing witness is a skill set that we all should have. And I think that would heal violence almost immediately if we all did that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people shy away from hearing it, but I've always said if the people were able to suffer through it all, surely we can bear to hear it.
I tried to avoid it, too. There's many times when they would start telling me stories, especially some of these war crime stories, that I begged them not to tell me. I mean, they knew when I would be saturated at some point, but other points they just would let it, you know, I hate the term rip, but they just let it rip. And I have a story of Nimana on my website, and Nimana is from Amitavitas, where the war crimes happened, and her house was right next to the mosque that was attacked and stuff. And on her property alone, there's 12 people that were burned to death in a small shed right next to her, the foundation of her home, and some of them also hidden the basement of her home, and they were all burned to death. And she brought her one neighbor over the next morning, and they kept going on and on about the stories. And, you know, I wish I didn't have eyes, and I wish I didn't have ears.
Yeah.
But, you know, one story was about this one grandmother that survived, and one of the infants was actually baked to death in the oven that she still uses to that day.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that bioculinary process come into thing. It's so rooted in their nature. And here every day she has to face that with her own stove, what we call a pitch. So it's these stories like this when you bear witness that you want to run away from, you want to avoid. Or when I do these kinds of presentations, it doesn't matter, from universities to a whole host of them, there's always someone that will come up to me and say, oh, it's so depressing. And or here's $5. And I'm sure they go home and they sleep under clean sheets and feel very good about themselves. I understand that all of us are in different ways of our process. And some of them aren't really at that point yet. And I don't really feel it's up to me to rush that. And not only that, I've gotten to the point where when there is curiosity, like I said earlier in the program, if they do question and have more questions, that shows me that they're ready in their process to bear witness, to hear, and to really listen.
How old are your children?
Now they're adults. I have a 31-year-old, a son, and a daughter who's 26.
Have they gone on any of these trips with you, and what do they say about their own heritage?
Well, we lived in Holland for 2 years, and my daughter got to come with me to Bosnia twice. And she also did quite a few trips with me. I used to do breakthrough intensive tours for women all throughout Europe and even the United States. And we'd go to Malta. It would be a mother and daughter tour to Malta and Gozo and all the Neolithic sites. And then we went to Crete, quite a few other places like that. And then my daughter has done some other things. My son, he hasn't done as much. Although he's very good at coffee cup readings, even though I never taught him, so he's got that Serbian side in him. They're very aware of their Serbian legacy, and they're very aware of the work I do. They're very supportive, but it's also been very difficult for them. And in a way, like my mother gave me what I thought was terrible abuse at times, and not that I abused my kids, but there were so many things that they just were shocked about or upset about or worried when I would go over there what would happen to me, or it was very painful for them. But when I turn around and I ask them now where they're at with that, they says, well, it built my character. So I guess you can't protect the kids from everything. And they turned out to be amazing adults and living their lives very well. And my son never went to be in the military, so he's never killed anyone else, which that was my whole goal, that he'll be the first generation in my family that has not killed somebody else's son or father.
Wow.
And for me, that's one of my greatest accomplishments.
Really?
He feels that way, too.
That's wonderful. You know, our time is running out. So on that note, I think we have to end. And I'm so grateful to you, Danica Anderson, for being my guest. It's been really wonderful.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. It's good to talk about these things.
It is very good. It awakens us in many ways. I thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
We are walking in a circle. We are walking hand in hand. We are walking in a circle to create the promised land. We are loving one another. We are crossing. sisters by our side.